welcome to the initial podcast. I think we're going to call it the Tribo Gatherings. And my first guest today is Connor Myant, who's a senior lecturer here at Imperial College. And we're set up today in the Trapezoid 2 meeting suite in the Dyson Design School.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So I think, yeah, we'll go through your journey because you obviously worked a lot in tribology, but now you primarily do like 3D printing technology. So let's work it through. So tell us about your, you were one of the first people, I believe, to do the soft tribology kind of testing.
First, perhaps at Imperial College. I'm sure that there were great people before me. Yeah, my PhD was focused on developing experimental techniques for measuring friction and lubricant behavior in soft contacts. And that was probably a bit of a change for most of the activities at Imperial, which prior to that had been focused on hard bearings, hard polymers, or just higher pressure contacts, really. I think that's probably the best way to describe it. There was one person that sort of really laid the groundwork before I joined, De Vicente, who's went on to become a professor in Spain. And he really laid the groundwork for me in terms of switching to things like PDMS. He tried a number of different rubbers and elastomers, and he sort of really discovered that, or set the standard that we should be using PDMS to look at these types of applications, and the application being for food. So I was, my PhD was sponsored by Unilever. It was part of a long research program they had into texture and feel and something that they termed taste perception. So it wasn't about the surface chemistry, taste, how your taste buds react to different chemicals in the mouth, but it's how you interpret texture as a taste. And the best example of that would be fat. Typically, if you remove fat from a product, we swear that it tastes different. But fat itself doesn't really have a taste, or you don't have a taste bud that's particularly sensitive to fat. It's more that perhaps fat lubricates the surface or covers the surfaces and prevents other chemicals from reaching your taste bud.
Okay, yeah.
And it very much changes the way the food breaks down in your mouth and the way the food lubricates your oral surfaces. And then that's the taste perception.
You know, they have describing words they use in panel testing. Do you know how they relate to kind of friction and viscosity? You know, like they have like grittiness or lusciousness or thickness. Do you know those kind of descriptors?
You've hit the nail on the head in terms of what the research is trying to do, you know, and it's trying to provide a repeatable measurement that you can relate to those subjective factors. The holy grail for these companies is to reduce or even remove the need for panel testing. Any consumer good, so it could be toothpaste, it could be foods or beverages. We did a little bit of work more recently looking at alcohol-free beer. There's definitely some changes in the taste and in the way that these beverages behave in your mouth. You're highly reliant on user feedback, but that's incredibly subjective because your perception of what is salty is different to mine, or what's sweet is different to mine, or fizzy, or any of these sorts of attributes. You therefore have to do a huge number of tests. You have to have a huge number of people involved before you actually get to see any patterns emerging. The original concept was, can we move away from that? Can we provide a sort of simple desktop experiment they can apply in their development phase to understand why they're getting the results they are from their panel tests? So if you change part of the formulation, do you see a certain trend from the panel test? Right, this becomes more gritty or more astringent, or it feels smoother. And then can we relate that back to a friction property or a time-dependent friction behavior, something like this? And I think that work's still ongoing. You know, we certainly didn't solve it in my time, that's for sure.
Yeah, we've recently done some work in our lab on chocolate, and it seems to, well, it's all based on a lot of what you did and Jason Stokes has published. And it's like, yeah, still, but still, yeah, you're right, it's still ongoing. And it's that correlation is what we do a lot of. I saw something I found really interesting when the recent conferences is, you know, the astringency measure. People know if it's a non-milk fat, you know, like a vegan product. And the difference in friction coefficient is like, is it 0.14 to 0.15 is what they measure in the lab, but humans, so they don't know if they're not measuring it right, or they're measuring it right, but actually humans detect something else. But the change in friction is actually tiny.
I imagine they are measuring it right. We underestimate the incredible ability of the human body to pick up on these small changes. So I did see some work once talking about on your fingers, your fingerprint acting like miniature stylus, like you have on an AFM. People were able to perceive changes in surface texture through the feel on their fingertips to a level that an AFM was able to pick up. The human body is just incredible at these things. And then also, you know, we tend to boil these things down to very simple systems. And in this case, we're just saying, oh, it's a friction thing. The likelihood is that it's far more complicated. There's surface chemistry, there's transient properties. It's multifactorial, essentially. I want to just give a shout out to Jason Stokes, who I probably should have mentioned earlier, because he was my supervisor along with Hugh Spikes. And he's been really leading the way in food tribology for telling our ages now, but, you know, coming up to a couple of decades for Jason. And he was also helped lay that foundational work before I joined as well.
Right, should we'll talk about the hip joint? So Connor then started working on the kind of hip joint part of biotribology. So moving into kind of a harder contact then. So was that with Richard, or how did you kind of get into that?
My journey has been an interesting one. And I've definitely benefited a number of times from being lucky, being in the right place at the right time. And I'm sure there's people who say, oh, you make your own luck and everything. I've always been a believer of luck provides the opportunity and then you've got to take it. You know, and you've got to see it through. So the next opportunity comes around because you did well with the first one, right? And yeah, I was coming to the end of my PhD. I was definitely maxing out the allowable time. I was getting close to the four-year deadline. I'd run out of funding. Philippa, Professor Khan, needed somebody to provide cover for one of her PDRAs who had just gone on maternity leave. I jumped to the chance. The role was to, they were looking at synovial fluid and trying to study the behavior of synovial fluid in hip joints. So it was still biotribology. It was still a sort of complex lubricant, but we'd gone from a soft contact to a hard contact. I spent the next 2 years as a PDRA. The maternity cover came to an end, but I'd got on really well with Philippa and another position opened in her research group. So I stayed on. And for those 2 years, we then established some optical interferometry techniques for measuring film thickness, but also sort of the lubricant behavior in a hard contact, which then led me on to my research fellowship, which was essentially looking at the same thing. So I then spent another 3-4 years studying synovial fluid.
And that was using like film thickness measurements of actual synovial fluid?
No. So the amount of synovial fluid in your joint isn't very much, right? There's a few mil and you're not too willing to give it up. I didn't have anybody willing to donate their synovial fluid. And I imagine extracting the synovial fluid is probably quite uncomfortable. The equipment that we were using, you know, we were probably using 50 to 100 mil of lubricant in each test. So I would have needed thousands of participants. We used the sort of the standard model synovial fluid, which at the time I think was 25% bovine calf serum, then diluted down with water. And one of the things that we did in that time was to sort of point out the differences between that model lubricant and the real synovial fluid. So although we didn't do any film thickness tests or friction tests with synovial fluid, we could just look at the composition differences and they were large. And then we could demonstrate, well, if we just change some of the formulation, we'll just increase the protein content or decrease or change the type of protein or change the pH, the stability, add a buffer. Really simple things. We're able to show that you get significantly different behavior. And therefore, showing that if you had that small difference between what the model fluid was and the real fluid, then I think it's a fair assumption to say that the real fluid is going to behave quite different as well. We tried to drive forward some realization around that within the community and then some changes to the model fluid.
No, that thing of getting like bio samples. I read a really funny paper recently. Well, the paper itself is a good paper, but they had this quite funny sentence where they were looking at tongue textures and they had a pig, a porcine tongue. And they said, we sacrificed the pig But also they did the test on the human's tongue, but they made it clear that they didn't sacrifice the human. It was just funny the way they like the way they described samples is like pig was sacrificed, but the human was not sacrificed.
How did they get the human tongue then?
I think someone just stuck their tongue out.
That sort of thing highlights really well, actually, how challenging any biosystem or biotribology, and I think any kind of bioengineering thing is, in that your muscles, and you know, at the end of the day, your tongue's a muscle, right? The mechanical properties of it change so much. Detaching a tongue and putting it in a test bed, you're going to have something that's actually quite different than if it was on a real live person. It's all well and good. There's definitely an area of researchers that try to recreate the real thing as much as possible. We're measuring friction in the mouth, so let's get a real tongue. And I think it's a dangerous game. You'll never recreate it until you've got like an in situ tribometer that you can put in somebody's mouth that doesn't alter the way that they behave. You're never going to fully recreate it. In my mind, anyway, I think the better way to do it is to have something that's incredibly repeatable. So then if I change one aspect, be that the surface texture, the topography of my specimen, maybe a mechanical property of my material or some part of my lubricant formulation, I'll see a difference and I'll know what drove that difference, you know, or the most likely thing that drove that difference was. And I think if you go into fully recreating the biological system so that you essentially have a biological system in vitro, I just don't think you'll ever achieve it.
I think the next step is to generate samples with closer chemistry, you know, because we're all still using PDMS, which is good, or textured, and then move into a system where the chemistry is closer to the tongue. I think that'd be quite a good little step. Completely agree. I think we're still so far away, you know, all we can do is these little steps, get closer and closer, chip away at it.
Exactly. And probably comes around to what it is that you're trying to measure and mimic. The surface chemistries are definitely what drive taste. You need to know what components are getting to your surface. Do they attach? Do you get biofilms? I'm sure they are very important for some systems and probably not important for others. Yeah, PDMS is great. It's been the gold standard for a long time. You're absolutely right that, you know, it's not tongue. It's not cheek. It's not teeth. So it's soft and it provides a good contact pressure for us to sort of get the right rheology. As long as we know that, as long as we acknowledge that, then I don't think there's a problem with it. You know, one thing that is normally missing from all of this work is saliva. And saliva probably has the biggest role, particularly when you're talking about astringent foods, right? So food that strips the mouth of the saliva, and then foods that cause you to salivate. We don't really have a good way of encapsulating that yet in the lab. That's a good challenge. You know, if there's anybody out there wanting to make a name for themselves in biotribology, there's a good 10 years of work there.
In the SGLE, in the bio kind of side of the conference, at the start of most presentations, they put the size of the market for like vegan-based alternative ingredients instead of milk and things. Mm. And it's incredible. You know, it's like, I can't remember, it's like 8 billion or something. And the only thing holding it back is that astringency effect. So once they solve this astringency thing, that market's going to open wide, isn't it? And you get, like, there's no stopping any food having a vegan alternative, which isn't inferior in some way.
That's exactly it. Yeah, we did a bit of work more recently around astringency and sort of could see that it was driven by certain proteins. You're absolutely right. You know, when you're looking at meat replacements, when you're looking at vegan foods that are formulated, we're not talking about food that you grow in a field. Selecting the right proteins is super important. There's tons of work to be done there.
How do you move from like the hip joint, doing your hip joint work on your synovial fluid? And then how did you get into your like printing?
So as I said, my journey's been an interesting one. During my sort of, 5-6 years of studying synovial fluid as a lubricant in hip joints, there was a big case, the big buzz at the time was around metal on metal hip joints. 10, 15 years before, these had been sort of hailed as they were going to be great. They started to use them a lot to sort of replace the gold standard at the time, which was metal on polymer. I think as well, that it partly driven by there'd been a sort of move to go to ceramic, but then there'd been some issues around the early ceramic products breaking.
cracking? Or
yeah, cracking? Yes. They would squeak. There was one particular type, I think, that were cracking. If that happens, you have to have what they call a revision. So they open you back up and they replace the broken component. And the idea was that metal's harder wearing, so it will last longer. It's a great assumption, but sadly, it didn't work out that way. So it was around the time I was working in the area that this particular product, I think it was the ASR hip joint, actually ended up being recalled from markets. They did a product recall on it. You know, and this isn't a...
Something inside your body.
Yeah. It's not a faulty washing machine, right?
You didn't take it back to IKEA. Like.
Yeah. I think it was Johnson & Johnson at the end. Can't remember the name of the original company that owned the product, but I think they were bought out by Johnson & Johnson. And I think Johnson & Johnson ended up like putting aside a crazy amount of money to pay for all the litigation and compensation stuff. The issue with the joint was that they had based the design of it on our understanding of other tribological bearings, which essentially was they said, we're going to make the bearing a bigger diameter. And it's like, okay, we'll make it a bigger bearing, so we'll have bigger surface area, so we'll lower the contact pressure, and then we'll get thicker films. If we get thicker films, this thing will last a lot longer. And it's a great idea, except that is purely based on our understanding of bearings, journal bearings, lubricated by oil. Synovial fluid is not an oil. And the other issue is that the type of joint that they're putting in, because they've made it bigger, it meant that the space that you're putting it into, you had a much lower tolerance of implantation. So if the surgeon could not get the two components aligned perfectly within this sort of very small tolerance of angles, then it wouldn't work. And basically, as it turns out, it's sort of multifactorial issue. Synovial fluid doesn't behave the way they thought. And essentially, the surgeons could just not meet the tolerances required. It's extremely hard to put joints in and get them perfectly lined up. When they're not lined up, they edge load. When they edge load, you have really high contact pressures, and then you get far faster wear, and therefore more of them need to come out. So that was sort of happening when I was there. And at the same time, these same companies were saying, we've got 3D printed hip joints, and these are going to be amazing. And it was a modular system where you'd stem in and you put this connector in and then you'd put the femoral head on, and it would all come in several parts and it'd all be joined together with like a tolerance fit taper joint. And I just remember sort of thinking, I think we've made the same mistake. We've made massive assumptions here that your 3D printed metal is going to be the same as your normal traditional metal that is cast or machined. And that just sort of sparked my interest, and I started to look into it. You know, even though you've got the same metal on paper, the same formulation, it's a wildly different metal at the end of the day, because the microstructure is completely different, because the manufacturing process is completely different, and therefore your tribological behavior is completely different. That's kind of where my journey into 3D printing started. I started from that sort of point of view, and then it just expanded, and now it's sort of absolutely everything to do with 3D printing. All my research is centered around additive manufacturing, 3D printing in some way.
I was thinking about it earlier on, and I as well had the printers from the beginning, you know, because you can remember that wooden one called the MakerBot.
Yeah, MakerBot. Yeah.
It's a little wooden one and a tiny little build plate. And then from that was so hard to use, and like most prints failed. It was so fiddly. And then you got to the there's a slightly better version.
3D printing's been around since the 80s, in terms of its first really established, recognized sort of group of technology. The big change was in, I think it was around 2003, Adrian Bauer. He started a project called the RepRap project.
Mm, yes, and self-replicating.
Self-replicating 3D printers. And that project has had more impact on the additive manufacturing industry than any other project. It's where your original Prusa, your original MakerBots and all these sort of things began. It was low cost, completely open source. You could build these at home. They build themselves in that you can reprint the parts and build another one. There's been more innovation, more commercial companies have come out because of that attitude. I think even a company like Formlabs, which isn't doing material extrusion, it's doing vat polymerization. I think even they would probably, their timeline and their activity in that was partly down to RepRap. when you and me first started playing with these things, they were basic and you could buy them quite cheaply. The technology's moved on so much, and I think it's moved on so much because of RepRap, because it spawned this huge international community that wanted to just keep adding and innovating with this sort of open source platform. And now, you know, you can pick up a 3D printer for a few hundred quid and they're good. They're not amazing. Okay. It's not an industrial quality sort of build. For that, you got to pay a lot more. And definitely the quality control and the repeatability on these things isn't great. As an educational tool, as a thing just to be a hobbyist with, you know, for labs that just need to build a sample holder or a little jig or something, it's just great.
We have the Prusa, the normal Prusa is a Mark III or something. We've got three of them. I tell you, like, what changed, not changed my attitude, but what amazed me with the Prusa. So we bought one and we moved from one of the kind of early maker bots where it always went wrong, always failed, just spaghetti in the morning. And I was leaving work fairly late and I had a part I wanted for this funny fly counter thing we built. In Prusa, we just finished building the printer. You know, on the software, it's like default settings. I'll sort it all out for you. I thought, it's no chance it's going to work. Put it on, went home, came back, and there's this perfect part just off the default settings out of the box. And I thought, this is amazing. You know, like no fiddling with settings, no worried about like setting different temperatures on the nozzle or the Prusa, like the way the open source has fed into all the different settings being like a default and the default settings just working so well.
Huge amount of research is still, research in additive manufacturing is still very much with what are the right settings. If you go to a 3D printing conference, 3/4 of it is still optimizing print settings for metal printing. In terms of an industrial application, that's where the majority of interest is. We're still trying to figure that out. I think we get a little bit, our expectations of technologies is that it knows what it's meant to be doing, right? But that's because we didn't know about the decades of sort of research beforehand, you know? So it's like with your computer, the number of things that you can change in terms of settings, it's there. They've already set them in that, just trust us. Yeah. This is how you want it set up. You know, it's the kind of the Apple versus the PC argument. Apples, they just work, like it's all done there for you. Whereas the PC, well, we think you want to change a few things, you know? That's because of all of the sort of development that's gone on before that. Definitely over the next 10 years, I think it's going to emerge from that. And then we'll see some really interesting stuff coming out where it's less about trying to optimize the build process and more about integrating the user into the build process. So additive allows you to do things that traditional manufacturing can't, just because of the nature of what we're doing. We're building something up rather than reducing it down. It allows you far more geometric complexity. I can then build that into sort of my design process in that I'm not just thinking, okay, I have to cut this away and then grind that out and then drill here or something. I almost just don't need to consider those things at all. So now I can go, well, what does the computer tell me is the best shape for this function? So I can just say, okay, well, I've got a load here and a load there, and then leave some space for me to put a screwdriver through here, generate me a solution. And then the computer will do it for you. And then you go, right, well, now let me apply some thermal modeling to that to represent my build process. So then I can account for warpage and peeling and this sort of thing. The computer will do that for you. And we've been developing for decades, you know, all of these CAE tools. Now we can actually use them.
So in terms of the, what do you call it when in your CAD design file, where you give it the, you know, where it's located to, where the screw holes are, and it generates the model for you in an optimized...
topology optimization or generative design.
Generative design. So are you using that?
I don't. My research isn't really concerned with either of those. Lots of my colleagues do in terms of, you know, they're generating more advanced software solutions, ideas. I've been more in the sort of 50% of my work sort of in bioprinting. So that's where the sort of tribology, biotribology sort of journey came into it. And the other 50% has been about automation. So we automate the design process, and then we're trying to automate the entire thing from design through to manufacture. How you can automate the design of a product, essentially have a CAD file at the end of that process that's finished. Then we do all of the treatment to that CAD file to turn it into a command file for the 3D printer. So that's things like slicing and toolpath generation. And we try to optimize each of these steps, essentially. We look at a real world product that could benefit from this automation, and then we create the systems, demonstrate that it's valid and scalable.
You did the like masks, didn't you? In the yes. COVID kind of custom masks for the people who work in the high dependency wards.
We've recently just received 2 years funding to carry on with that work. The idea is that if you can take a 3D scan of somebody's face, you can customize a respirator mask for them. Typically, you're always paying for that process. It's a lot like going to get a tailored suit. Most of us go and buy our suits that are mass produced, and you have a number of options. They're just different sizes. And the sizes are trying to represent clusters of sort of phenotypes, populations, whatever. But we know that if you went and got that tailored, it would fit even better. It would feel nicer and everything, right? But you're going to have to pay the tailor for their time. You're paying for their expertise, their skill, and then they're going to manufacture it themselves as well. So you've got to pay for that. Our point is, well, what if I automate that? If the tailor's going through the same decision-making process that they do every time, then I can write that as an algorithm. I can write that as a set of code commands, right? And then that can be automated. So it's, you're automating it for the same product every time. It's not that I can give it a whole new product and it will know what I'm trying to do. So it's not like an all-conquering AI thing. So with the respirator masks, they're always placed on the same place on the face. So if I can extract that data from a 3D scan that represents where the mask is trying to be, essentially that sort of topographical dimension, that 3D dimension, I can then import that into my CAD package and drive a parametric model, which just changes its shape based on the dimensions that I've given it. And we set that up during COVID. We wanted to do something, you know, we're all stuck at home, and we wanted to sort of do something that we could do online together as a group. And it was people in my research team. So some of us in London, there were some in Singapore, some different places around Europe, in the Middle East. And everybody would sort of come together. We'd have these regular meetings on Zoom or Teams and build up this code together. And then we set up a research project where participants could sign up online. So they would download a 3D scanning software onto their phone. So they just use mobile phones, scan their face, submit that into our system. We'd generate our results from there, basically. And that was really successful. We really enjoyed it. We obviously didn't have any impact on COVID. I don't want to try and claim that we were, you know, at the front line or anything like this, but we definitely demonstrated that you could automate the design of these things. And the idea would be that once you've got the design file, you can send that to your 3D printer. So that step is automated as well. And the manufacturer is automated because it's being 3D printed. So that's what we're doing now. We're taking that work. We've teamed up with Sheffield's Children's Hospital. We're going to be applying the same principles, the same work, to looking at how you can customize what they call NIV masks. These are the type of respirator masks you're given when you're in hospital. We'll show that we can customize these for children. These are children with, you know, complications. They're going to be on breathing apparatus for a prolonged period of time, maybe all their life. And the fit of the NIV mask has a huge impact on the quality of life of those patients. So if they're not breathing right, or if they can't catch their breath because the air that's meant to be supplied to their lungs is being lost through leakage in the mask. So you got a poor mask to face interface or fit, gases, air, maybe it's medicine that you're given this way as well, and it's leaking out. So if you can get a perfect seal, that should improve the quality of life and perhaps improve the sort of therapeutic side as well. So
it would make such a huge impact to the children. But also, like, what I quite like about that project you're doing is all the technology exists. Exactly. So that you can scan with your phone, like you can get printers fairly cheap. They won't mind spending 100 quid for a mask that is brilliantly fitted or however much it costs. So it's all like possible. It's just clever people like yourself and your team, and you'll get it done, you know. It's a very achievable thing.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, we're without trying to put ourselves down too much, like, we don't feel like we're doing anything hugely innovative, because the way we see a lot of our work is we're taking a bit of that and a bit of that and a bit of theirs and a bit of that technology, and I'm just adding them together. That's the innovation, is to demonstrate to people that you can put all of these things together and then you've got something really significant, something really powerful. And I think our ethos has always been that 3D printers are far more powerful and are capable of far more than we currently ask them to do. And that's typically because our imagination is lacking, our understanding of the technology is lacking, and then the software involved is really restrictive. So we spend a lot of our time writing our own software because there's nothing commercially available that does what we need it to do. So we go and write our own.
With the masks as well, there's nothing stopping that technology going out to every like high dependency ward.
I hope, you know, if we have a conversation around it again in a few years' time, we'll be telling you that exactly that this is being, you know, adopted and scaled up. They have a term around health economics. Is it cost viable? So these things are mass produced and they're produced really cheaply, right? So we're never going to be able to create a mask, 3D print a mask at the same unit cost as a mass production technique. And we don't want to, you know, we're not going to try to achieve that. Instead, it's about showing that a 3D printed mask will outperform a mass produced mask. And then that performance gain will translate to cost savings somewhere else in the patient, what they call like their care pathway. So if the patient doesn't have a well-fitting NIV mask, what does that mean to NHS in terms of added care, more people who have to look after that person? Maybe they're on the ward for longer. If our mask could be 10 times, 50, 100 times the price of a mass-produced mask, but if it's providing significant cost savings somewhere else in that pathway, then it's worthwhile. It's not necessarily about creating cheap products, but it's about looking at that entire service.
My brother's wife works as a nurse on the high dependency unit in Bristol during COVID. The scarring and things she had on her face from those masks.
That was exactly our inspiration. So there was a lot of work going on in terms of trying to find other manufacturing ways to produce masks because there were PPE shortages. So they're trying to look for alternative manufacturers. People trying to like augment supply lines. You know, were there other materials that we could use to sort of help with this sort of supply shortage? Yeah, we were sort of more interested in, well, is there something else that we can help with? Is there something else that we can look at here? And we were sort of seeing a lot of articles about bruises and blistering and so from the masks. And that's because your typical mask at the moment, and we're talking about the plastic masks, right? Not your surgical fabric type mask. They have these large sort of silicon or elastomeric seals on the side of them. They're there to try and account for all the facial differences that we see in a population. So you put it on and then to make it fit, you have to kind of like compress that seal. So you apply more and more strap pressure. If you're somebody whose face just doesn't fit the mask because maybe you've got a big nose, maybe you've got odd shaped chin, whatever it is, right? It probably doesn't even need to be that odd, right? You know, making it sound extreme, but it's probably very normal facial types. You're going to have to apply a lot of strap pressure. That puts a lot of pressure on your skin. You're wearing these things all day long. Then you've got a tribological issue because you're getting fretting, you're getting a small amount of rubbing. That's what causes blisters and bruising. If you can get something that perfectly fits, then I don't need large strap pressure. I've spread the contact pressure around the whole mask and not just loading it in one place, like on the bridge of your nose or on your cheekbone, should then help to lower the incidence of these problems. We haven't been able to demonstrate that physically, but we've been able to demonstrate it in terms of like digital fitting and showing that across a really broad set of demographics over a really broad population, we can achieve a really good fit every time, which means that for those people who don't fit a normal mask, they can have a mask that fits. That's the idea.
Did you see Mark Masson's paper?
Yeah.
It was like, was it beeswax cream or something? The one that kind of won, I can't remember now. The best thing to reduce like friction and wear on your face, but mask to skin was, he did the testing, didn't he? In COVID, and this, I can't remember what one, but there was quite a big difference between like Vaseline and cream. And
Mark did some great work. Again, he was sort of looking at this from another perspective, very much looking at this as a tribologist, whereas I was coming at it from more the design engineering side. He showed that, yeah, you know, using different everyday moisturizers, everyday lubricants, you could have an impact.
On the 3D printing, I've seen some of your, so your four-dimensional printer, five dimensionally with the rotating bed. And you're going back to that, you know, 3D printing's got a lot of potential. I think the way you print it then, the overhangs and everything is removed.
Your typical printer has got three axes, right? So your typical type of printers we were talking about earlier, sort of rep-rack printers and most of the industrial ones as well, actually, they just work on three axes. But if you think about CNC machines, you know, they've been working with 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 axes for a while, right? People are starting to do that in additive, but typically they have to buy a robotic arm. They're quite expensive. Again, the biggest barrier is software. To 3D print a part, you slice it. That creates your 2D layer stack. And then you draw out the layers. The machine, the printer is just drawing out each layer one on top of the other. When you move up into higher number of axes, the orientation of those layers and eventually the shape of those layers as well is changing within each layer. It's not this 2D stack where every layer is the same anymore. Now it's the angle between each layer has changed. Perhaps your layer isn't flat. Perhaps it's curved. Perhaps the curvature of the layer changes every time. Beyond three axes sort of 3D printing is great. It's super exciting. It's a big challenge. I think there's going to be some really cool innovations in that space in the next sort of 5 years. And most of it's in the software. You know, it's really as it is the software. And I won't go into it hugely now. I'll probably end up boring everybody. But the difference between slicing something in three axes and then slicing it for five, the mathematical load, the computational load is huge. When we slice something for a normal printer, it can solve in, you know, 30 seconds. And when we do it for five axes, it takes half an hour, right? So it's just, that's where the challenges are, is how you automatically create the instructions for the printer, the order in which it's placing material down to build your part. And that becomes quite complex.
Yeah. Will the output, the G code, is it still be that kind of XY extrusion?
So all you've got now is you've got XYZ and then a set of angles. And there's a number of different ways you can do it. But essentially, if you think all your G code is doing is telling your print head, could be a laser, could be whatever, but let's just say your print head, where it's depositing material. So it starts off from, you know, X1, Y1, Z1, and then move into X2, Y2, Z2. And you're telling it, okay, well, move it at a given speed and extrude at a given rate and these kind of things. Now what you can do is you can say, well, what is the normal at X1, Y1, Z1? And what's the normal? What angle should the print head be pointing at? Now, in a normal three-axis system, the print head has just always got a set angle, a set vector. It's just pointing down. It's aligned with your Z-axis. When we move up in axes, now I'm moving that around. So I've got a azimuth and whatnot angle. You can either put that into your G-code as these different angles, or you can put it in as normals. It's really just about how the hardware then interprets it. But yeah, it's still G-code. It's still the same G-code they've been using in CNC CAD-CAM since whatever, you know, the 70s and 80s. That base language hasn't moved on. It does mean that you end up with command files that are going to be millions of lines long, but it's just text at the end of the day. So computationally wise, that's fine. The challenge is in the slicing in the toolpath generation, doing things like collision checks and stuff like this. Most CNC machining still isn't fully automated in how it generates the toolpaths. And that we've been doing that now for like 4 or 5 decades. So it's a big challenge.
I suppose going back to like the Prusa, kind of how well they've optimized. So with the five-axis thing, I suppose it'll go on that same journey, won't it? It'll probably be really difficult to start with and be loads of failed prints, but eventually it'd be open source or something and there'd be lots of optimization and these will be the standard way of printing or a way of printing quite successfully, you know?
Bringing it back full circle, we have put out an open source five-axis system. The machine is an add-on to your Prusa. The idea is, you know, your Prusa, you can buy one, I think, pre-assembled for about £600. And then for an extra couple of £100, you can add two more axes onto it. The software, you have to download Rhino. I think there's a small cost associated with that, but then you can download our plugin, which we wrote in Grasshopper, and then you're up and running. You've got a cheap five-axis system. So, you know, for about £1,000, you can do five-axis 3D printing. And compare that to most other commercial offerings out there, that, you know, hundreds of thousands. So that was our aim, was to just get something out there. I would love to try and have something that's on a level of the RepRap revolution, right? So it's fully open source. You can build the machines yourself, and it's a simple kind of Python interface or something that just allows other people then to go on and innovate. To me, that's what RepRap achieved, and I'd love it if we were able to do the same thing with Five Axes.
For sure, I haven't asked about it or any like companies or...
We're not trying to commercialize it, and that's probably why other commercial companies don't want to hear from us, because it would be really disruptive. They want to make money out of it, and we don't. We want to set people on a way for them to go and make money out of it. And I think that's what RepRap did. You know, MakerBot became MakerBot and went on, I think they eventually bought out by Stratasys or 3D Systems or something for a tidy sum. But they started because of an open source platform, and they carried on with that ethos. And that's what we'd like to see as well. Perhaps there'll be other companies that then startups that enter the Five Axis space using this platform, but they've innovated with it and they've created something additional. You know, MakerBot was just about simplifying the startup process. You could buy a MakerBot machine, they'd built it to a certain standard, and it allowed you to then go on and do some 3D printing. And whether or not somebody does that with the Five Axis, or they add something to it. So maybe they add something around fiber reinforcement layer or electronics or whatever. I don't know. Somebody's out there who's got that imaginative step, that creativity, and they just put that additional thing in and create a company out of it. So I would like it though, you know, in the ideal world, that it remains open source.
So what are you kind of doing? So you've got your 3D, 4D.
4D printing something else. It's something that annoys me. It's a name given to printing with shape memory materials. Probably heard of like shape memory alloys. And these are like metals that can be bent into somewhere and then you heat them and they sort of spring back. So people are like, they talk about them for deployment in space and these little like Mars landing robots, whatever. So you can 3D print with those metals and create simple robotic type stuff, but it's just 3D printing with shape memory materials. Yeah. But the first person who did it coined the phrase 4D printing, and it's annoyingly stuck. And the idea is that, you know, you're printing with time, additional dimension, but I'm like, everything exists in that dimension. So all 3D printing is 4D printing. It's just one of my many gripes.
So you got your 3D printing kind of stuff, and what else you got going on? What else are you kind of working on?
I still have a certain amount within tribology. As all good tribologists know, it's everywhere. We like to claim a very large amount of science. Definitely still got some activities in that space. And it's definitely what's driven me, or, you know, got me to what I'm doing now. You know, I doubt I would have ended up doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for my work in biotribology. I do a fair amount of bioprinting, looking at developing processes to allow us to print with biological material, typically with syringes that are loaded with cells, something in your deposit them out. So it's a material extrusion process. And we're looking at developing other processes. So we look at using vat polymerization. So this is where you use light to cure material in selected places. And we are developing biologically friendly vat polymerization processes. So we do a lot of work with hydrogels, and that's been a lot of fun. Algae and different bacterias. We don't do much with human cells. We have done a little bit, but for that, I can't do that in my lab because there's safety risks and so forth associated with that. So we do that with colleagues in the medical faculty. Then we do the Five Axis work that you mentioned, and we do the sort of automated work as well.
How many people have you got like with you? What is it?
Right now, I think I've got 4 PhD students, 2 research assistants, 2 PDRAs, postdoctoral research assistants. It's going to fluctuate quite a bit again this year. One of my PDRAs just been offered an academic position at another university. So congratulations to Ali. Commiserations for me. I think at one stage, around about COVID, for whatever reason, I had a very big group. I had something about 7 or 8 PhD students, about 4 research assistants. And now it's dropped back down. I took some time off work for our first kid, and I deliberately didn't recruit, you know, for a little while before and stuff. So I'm in a kind of phase at the moment of trying to get some funding in, which is the eternal job of an academic, and then hopefully regrow the group again.
Is there anything you'd like to like plug before you kind of sign off? Anything like any papers or conferences or?
I don't really want to plug my own work. You can easily find me on LinkedIn. Do reach out, check out all my papers on Google Scholar. That's all fine. But I'd just love to plug everybody that's helped me along the way. Hugh and Philippa and the rest of the tribology group. I mean, you had a role to play in that as well. making our lives a lot more fun during the PhD years. Greg Sawyer being a massive influence. Jason as well. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Jason and his desire to do the original work that we did.